The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
I, Zohran Kwame Mamdani,
I, Zohran Kwame Mamdani,
do solemnly swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States,
that I will support the Constitution of the United States,
the Constitution of the State of New York,
the Constitution of the State of New York,
and the Charter of the City of New York,
and the Charter of the City of New York.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
Of the office of the mayor of the city of New York.
Of the office of the mayor of the city of New York.
According to the best of my ability.
According to the best of my ability.
So help me God.
So help me God.
There it is. Which God is he talking about? We'll see. Nothing speaks to change more than a Muslim mayor there in the city of New York taking the oath of office. He's there being read in by a communist, Bernie Sanders, and all the while placing his hand on the Quran, the holiest text of Islam. What a change. What a change for New Yorkers. I don't know how many people are rolling over in their graves right now seeing that or knowing that this is going on. This is crazy to see what's happening in New York, this iconic city of the United States, and really an icon of capitalism in the Western world. Definitely a drastic change taking place there. We're going to talk about that today on the program. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Brent Nachtigall. I'm filling in for Mr. Stephen Flory. We're coming to you today live, February 2nd, from the campus here of Herbert W. Armstrong College. So we have a new mayor in New York, this iconic city where everything changed 25 years ago. And now it is changing again. And Mamdani isn't wasting any time telling us how he's going to rule. Here's another clip from his inauguration just yesterday.
We will govern without shame and insecurity, making no apology for what we believe. I was elected as a democratic socialist, and I will govern as a democratic socialist. I will not abandon my principles for fear of being deemed radical.
So, what does that mean? It looks like New York is going to get some radical policies. I think something we've learned from all of these type of people over the past few years is when they tell you and they talk about their radical ideas and they actually get the power to then go ahead and do them, they actually do them. Most of the time you have politicians coming in there and they're talking about all these wonderful, great things they want to do. And then they get in and they don't actually fulfill those promises. But when it comes to the radical ideas, well, they're going to go ahead and do them. And we already have a sense for what some of these radical ideas are. This is a story that was published just this morning. Mamdani's first act scraps order recognizing anti-Zionism as anti-Semitism. This is from Israel Hayom, but it's reported many places. It says, hours after his inauguration, Mayor of New York City Zohran Mamdani took a series of steps that marked a sharp break from the legacy of his predecessor, former Mayor Eric Adams. His actions drew harsh criticism, particularly from the Jewish community leaders in the city. Within a short time after his swearing in, tweets were deleted from the official mayoral X account from the Adams era that dealt with combating anti-Semitism and defending Jews in New York. So this is the official Twitter or X channel or where the mayor posts, and it formerly belonged to Adams and now belongs to Mamdani. And he's going through the list of all of Adams' tweets and he's like, we needed to delete a few of those, particularly the ones that talk about the clampdown, the executive actions that Adams put in regarding anti-Semitism. Now those have to go. This wasn't all that he did. Continuing from this article, in parallel with the deletion of tweets, Mamdani issued his first mayoral executive order, which was canceling all orders issued by Adams starting on September 26, 2024. the day a federal indictment was filed against Adams on corruption charges. But what were most of those about? So that's the excuse. Now, what were most of those, many of those orders about? Among the cancelled orders were sensitive orders relating to the Jewish community and its safety. One of them is Executive Order 51 from May of this year, which established the unprecedented mayor's office for combating anti-Semitism. Another order is Executive Order 52 from June of this year, which adopted the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism that recognized demonization of Israel and discrimination against it as expressions of modern anti-Semitism. That's not anti-Semitism. We can hate on the Jewish state just because. That's never going to be classified as anti-Semitism. Additionally, two orders signed last month were canceled. Executive Order 60, which banned boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, against Israel in the context of municipal contracts. So that means that, hey, municipal contracts that come out from City Hall with Israeli companies, we're allowed to boycott Israel. We are going to do, doesn't matter whether the boycott is for Judean Sumerian communities that are employing Arab workers. This is what's so crazy about the BDS movement. If you don't know, it's basically saying we're not gonna support Israeli organizations, be it ones that work in the West Bank or in Israel proper. There's different varieties of it. And who does this hurt? Well, who do the Israeli organizations employ mostly in the West Bank? Oftentimes, they're employing the Arabs. And so the flow on economically for the BDS movement is actually hurting the Arabs inside Judea and Samaria. But that's all right. That's a side point. Anyway, that's gone. Order 61, another one, which was designed to regulate protest activity near synagogues and houses of worship. This after violent anti-Israel protests that occurred near a synagogue in the Upper East Side, which hosted a Nefesh B'Nefesh event. We can no longer afford the Jewish people and their synagogues in our city extra special protection from the state. It's just not fair. If we're not protecting the mosques, why are we protecting the synagogues? Well, I'll give you a good reason. When was the last time that a right-wing extremist Jew went and did something inside of a mosque? Well, I think you know the answer to that one. So these are some of the orders that have come in on day one. And so you can just imagine, I mean, the Jewish community in New York, they've had it rough for some time. It seems like not a week passes when a new act on the subway or on the streets where a Jew is targeted just because they're wearing a kippah or something like that. And that's not going to go away. I mean, just think about what happened in Australia. I mean, you had this massive Jewish event, not that big. It was a Bondi Beach event in Sydney where they were celebrating Hanukkah, and there wasn't that many police officers there. And so they took advantage of this. The terrorists did. Islamist terrorists took advantage of this and mowed down people at this Jewish event. Now, in New York City, if you've got a synagogue or something like that, it's going to be harder to get the security that you need. This is what the director of the National Jewish Advocacy Center, Mark Goldfeder, claimed. He said that the deletion of the tweets, which constitute an official record of the municipal activity, raises legal questions and could constitute a breach of public trust. Especially against the backdrop of the sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents in the city since October 7th. In a scathing letter to the mayor's office, it was claimed that, quote, it's hard to overstate how disturbing it is that one of the first acts of the new administration was to delete official statements about the safety of New York Jews. Indeed, give it a day or two. Give it a few. If you're going to change the policy of the former mayor, at least make it seem that, you know, it's a little bit delayed, or this was something we came to after we really made some good considerations. No, let's strip away all of those executive actions, and then we will consider whether they were good or not. That's what they basically said. We may reinstate them. Well, how about you do the study first to see if, because human life is in danger, and then decide whether you want to remove it or not. No, other way around, because this is a policy change. It's we're going to start from the very beginning to show that the Jews might have got special favor in New York City, but it's not going to continue. Here's another bit from that speech, clip 7.
Together, we will tell a new story of our city. This will not be a tale of one city governed only by the 1%, nor will it be a tale of two cities, the rich versus the poor. It will be a tale of 8.5 million cities, each of them a New Yorker with hopes and fears, each a universe, each of them woven together. The authors of this story will speak Pashto and Mandarin, Yiddish and Creole. They will pray in mosques, at shul, at church, at gurudwaras and mandirs and temples. And many will not pray at all. They will be Palestinian New Yorkers in Bay Ridge who will no longer have to contend with a politics that speaks of universalism and then makes them the exception.
So New York is going to be a place for everybody, especially the Palestinians of Bay Ridge. Notice there, he forgot. I mean, he said, the authors of this story will speak Pashto, Mandarin, Yiddish, and Creole. What about English? Like, is there going to be some English? I don't know. Maybe this is just a moot point, but put English in there might be good for an English-speaking city. He's saying New York is a place for everyone. But I don't know. We'll see how long it takes before New York's Jews have to go elsewhere, have to leave. So you can see that this is not going to be good for New York. What does it say for America and for New Yorkers voting in a communist into City Hall, the crowning city of capitalism? It's a strange time indeed. There's a scripture that Mr. Sam Livingston recently went to on the scripture. It's Deuteronomy 28 and verse 43. It says, the stranger, the one with strange ideas, you could say ethnic stranger, but you could also say one with just totally foreign concepts of law and order, God, religion. The stranger that's within you, within your gates, shall get up very high, or get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. Is this not happening before our eyes here in New York City, as it happened in London decade ago as well? People with foreign values, they're ruling. And God said this was going to happen to the nations of Israel. This prophecy there in Deuteronomy chapter 28, it's for the nations of Israel. It's for the nations of Israel today. These are nations that include the United States, that include America as well. Just reading through a portion of Mystery of the Ages this morning, Mystery of Ancient Israel, Mystery of Israel. It goes into showing who Israel is today. And if you don't know that, then the prophecies of your Bible that are meant for the end time, who are they for? Are they for the Jewish state? We'll see some other prophecies a little bit later that prove that Israel does not refer to the Jewish state today. So you can definitely order a copy of Mystery of the Ages and understand when Leviticus or Deuteronomy talks about what's going to happen to Israel today, and you can correspond that to what's happening in the United States, Ephraim, UK, the other nations of the British Commonwealth as well. On a lighter note, this is kind of funny. My wife tells me that when I do substitute on this program, that I'm full of ranting and yelling. And so I wanted to have a funny element here relating to Mamdani's office and his official taking over of the Twitter handle. So you can put this next tweet up. I think this is quite funny. Can actually, this is from Mamdani, but it was actually from Adams. Today at the UN, I met with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu at a time when much of the world has turned its back on Israel. Well, who's doing that now? I remain steadfast in my support for the Jewish state. Israel has a right to defend itself, eliminate Hamas, and bring every single hostage home. So Mamdani's name now and his face is attached to that tweet. Although I hardly believe that he believes in that sentiment. Anyhow, if you want to have a little laugh, as Hillel Full did, a commentator from Israel, you can go through and look at some of those tweets. And we have that screenshotted in case he decides he doesn't like that and he wants to stricken that from the mayoral record as well. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, Prime Minister Netanyahu was in Miami for most of this past week. He spoke at a synagogue about what the Jews have to do inside America. And I don't have this queued up there in the notes, fellas, but I know that you have it. Just hear what Netanyahu thinks is going to happen in America and the need of the Jewish people inside America to even have to fight back. If you can play that clip.
I say to you, the members of the Jewish community of the United States, the last thing you should do before anti-Semitic attacks, as they attack you, the last thing you should do is lower your head and seek cover. That's not what you should do. You should stand up and be counted. You should fight back. You should speak up. You should attack your attackers. You should delegitimize the delegitimizers. That's what you need to do. And I have a secret for you. Nobody will fight for you more than you fight for yourself. That's what happens. When Israel fights for itself, all the governments, not all, but so many of the governments in the world come to us. When Israel is strong, others want to partner with us. You stand up and be counted, and you will see the difference. Don't be afraid. Don't cower. Don't lower your head. And to the young college student who asked me before, 17 years old, he said, what to do? Speak up. Stand up. Fight back. That's the important thing. It's called fight, fight, fight. And then we shall win, win, win with God's help. Shana Tova to all of you. Next year in Jerusalem, that's tomorrow. Thank you.
So that was December 31st, a synagogue in Miami speaking to a Jewish audience. And it should be worrying. You know, he's in the United States and he's talking about what you need to do if you come across anti-Semitic attacks against you, delegitimizing you in protests, or you need to stand up and fight back. Now, this is in the United States, as a nation founded on Judeo-Christian values, as much as Tucker would like to say, just Christian values, just New Testament values. No, the entire Bible. And here you have Netanyahu having to say something like that. Now, I mean, you never want to see these things happen, but New York has a mayor now who certainly sides. It's obvious, it's out there. Again, he's radical policies, first acts in office against the Jews, could be seen, what was. And then he has a history of siding with Hamas. This just came up on the Twitter stream this morning, and I'd forgotten about it. But if you could play this, this is Mamdani, 2017. So this is before he was a very important individual. And this is before October 7th. But look at who he's choosing to praise.
In 2017, Zohran Mamdani released a rap track that praised five convicted Hamas funders known as the Holy Land Five. Now he wants to run New York. Mamdani says, look him up. So we did. These five men were convicted of funneling over $12 million to Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization responsible for the murder, rape, and kidnapping of civilians, including Americans. Mamdani sent his love to convicted Hamas funders. Let that sink in.
So, I mean, this is in his roots. This is what he has glorified before. These were Americans that were inside the United States funneling money to Hamas in the Middle East, and look what Hamas does. And so, again, you can't say that everything anybody ever said in their past they still hold to, but he hasn't come out and disavowed these type of things. So we'll see what happens. I mean, it is worrying that his first acts are considered against the Jewish community and anti-Semitic. Even after October 7th, this is still ringing in the ears of Israelis. The world just wants to stop from mentioning it. Stop bringing it up. That was so 2 years ago. But not really. I mean, just the last body just got out a couple days ago. So it's still very fresh. And as it would be very fresh for Israelis, all my Israeli friends still, and it will be that way. But what was so worrying about after October 7th is October 8th, October 9th, 10th, you start to have not pro-Israel protests, pro-Hamas protests, pro-Palestinian protests throughout the Western world, including New York City. It's like a horrific anti-Semitic attack takes place, and then it encourages more people to come out in support of it. This is the way it is with the scourge of anti-Semitism. They don't shock people enough. They actually promote them more This is a story from December 28th from what happened down in Australia. After Bondi Beach Hanukkah massacre, anti-Semitic incidents in Australia spike 600%. So you just had the second worst shooting of all of Australia's history, the worst attack on Jews in all of Australia's history, and it is promoted this scene of coming together with the Jewish people. No, anti-Semitic attack, anti-Semitic fervor online increases 600% in the aftermath. Now, this is crazy. Australia is gone. You can have a little celebration or a little moment of silence at the Sydney Opera House on New Year's Eve as they did, but the proof is it's in the open. I went there in 2014, grew up in Australia, Western Australia, and then I left there in 2004. Go back 10 years later in South Sydney, Wollongong, and we're driving past a park, and I've come from the Middle East at that point after living in Israel for a bit, and what I see is hundreds of Muslim men in the park where you play soccer and Australian rules football praying. And I'm like, what country am I in? Like, this was 10 years ago, an hour's drive from Bondi, probably just over an hour's drive. And so Australia, the sickness is there. I mean, unless there's going to be a huge change from the Australian government that fights back against it, you know, what hope is there? This is a question that Victor Davis Hanson has been asking. He's one of my favorite commentators going back over a decade now, just not just for his historical perspective as a historian, and he's writing clarity on what's happening today. Also, his writing style is really just easy to get through as well. He's actually out right now. He's just had if you're a follower of VDH, he's just had an operation, I think it is. He's had a condition for 9 months, didn't really know about it. It's pretty serious. His last recording of his podcast took place on December 22nd, the same date that this article comes out. So we haven't had official word how it went. But, I mean, there's been so many great commentators that we have lost over the past decade. Like the voices of reason that you can look to and think, well, at least I'm going to get a logic-based, historically sound take on what's happening today. Krauthammer and people like that, they're gone. VDH is in a very, very, very serious health trial right now. God says in Isaiah chapter 3, that he's going to take away from Israel, from Judah, from Jerusalem. He's going to take away some of these men, the mighty man. This is verse 2 of Isaiah 3. Going to take away the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient, the captain of 50, the honorable man, the counselor, the cunning artificer, the eloquent orator. If you've ever heard of his speeches. I mean, he was on Tucker Carlson once a week for years talking on Tucker Carlson's show. You know he's an eloquent orator, and I will give them children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. Has that happened? I'm not trying to give a foregone conclusion for Victor Davis Hanson here. I certainly hope that we have his voice still. But these voices of sanity and reason and logic, with historical soundness in their voice, with an understanding of, we've tried this before and it didn't end well, or they tried it before and it didn't end well. If you're going to remove the Bible from your education, you better hope you have some historians. But they're diminishing. They're going. Anyway, he talks about this question about where does this end? Where does this anti-Semitic fervor end in the West? This is an article, Slouching Towards Open Season on the Jews. He says, Jews celebrating Hanukkah were just slaughtered by Muslim gunmen on an Australian beach in an imitation of the October 7th massacres. An inert Europe is cancelling Christmas celebrations out of fear of threats of violence from Muslim minorities. In the West, when an Islamist shoots a Jew, politicians often offer two bizarre remedies, gun control or a task force to tackle Islamophobia. Yet, our political class rarely offers data on the overwhelming preponderance of targeting Jews rather than Muslims, much less than the vast disparity of Muslim or Jewish on Muslim versus Muslim on Jewish violence. To catalog all the recent violence against the Jews in the Western world would fill a book. Yeah, where's the catalog of the stream of attacks of Jews against Muslims? Where is that? Then he turns in his article to the anti-Semitism infecting the right. He talks about the Tuckers, how much Tucker has changed. I mean, this is one of his friends. Spoke to him every week, went on his show. He says this at the conclusion. Somehow many on the right forgot who funds the virulently anti-American mouthpiece Al Jazeera. Again, Al Jazeera is funded out of Qatar. Or where the 9/11 murderers came from. Or who killed Americans in Syria, Lebanon, and on the Red Sea, our latter Iraq. Or whom the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, and theocratic Iran have vowed to destroy. And as for October 7th and what followed, Israel waited in vain for nearly 3 weeks for Hamas to give up the 3,000 terrorists who murdered 1,219 Jews, wounded 3,400, and took 254 hostages before mounting a full invasion of Gaza. Are we forgetting what's happened? Who the actual enemy of the West is? Where does it end? Where does it all end? This is his conclusion. Either there will be an 11th hour Western intolerance of anti-Semitism, a limit of student visas and immigration from the illiberal nations of the Middle East, a return to melting pot assimilation, an end to DEI tribalism, and a reform of the weaponized university curricula, or we will see more images of gunmen shooting Jews as if they were mere animals. Well, I think these are the last words he's put on ink, printed before his operation. Are we going, if there's not a huge change, we're going to see more images of this taking place. I mean, you can see this intolerance. And the reason we bring up the intolerance of anti-Semitism isn't just because of the hatred against the Jewish people, which is a manifestation of the devil's hatred towards the Jews and what they represent and their relationship with God and the giving of the law and everything in many ways to the Jewish people over time and their willingness to stand up for the law throughout history and be sacrificed for it, to be martyred for it. That's not just the reason. It's because anti-Semitism leads to far greater conflagration all the time, every time, unless there is an overwhelming, horrific event that shakes people to the core. It happened in Israel. It shook Israelis to the core October 7th, and they fundamentally took a different course. They changed course. There's no chance that's going to happen in the United States, but what I'm trying to show you is a precursor to rise in anti-Semitism everywhere. You see it happening in Germany, Europe, UK, US. It's always a precursor to greater violence. So it's a warning sign. It's a flashing red warning sign from history and from the Bible. That's why it should worry us. Now, if you look everywhere, it's growing. It's on the right, of course. This was an article in the New York Times, even. It's called, "Is the Future of MAGA and the Republican Party Anti-Israel?" Now, this has a new title. I printed this off a couple of days ago. I noticed it's got a new title now. New York Times decided that this was too much to put as their headline. But this is interesting that even the New York Times is it really going to become the place of the Republican Party that it's going to become an anti-Israel party? Is that really going to happen? This is the article. It says, when historians look back on President Trump's second term, they may see as the pinnacle of the Republican Party's enduring support for Israel. They may also see it as the moment when the partnership undergirding this support between evangelical Christians and the Republican foreign policy establishment began to unravel. But inside the Republican Party, something seems to be shifting. A recent Manhattan Institute survey of Republicans nationwide found that a majority of the party's longstanding voters remain firmly pro-Israel, but a sizable minority are often critical of the Jewish state. Now, Victor Davis Hanson goes on and talks about what's happening in the Republican Party in this next clip.
So for cultural, economic, political, military, it's been a win-win situation for that alliance. And I don't know where all of a sudden... this was a particularly untimely statement, he said, because it comes on the heel of radical Islamicists in Australia wounding 40 people and murdering 16 innocents from an appeasement policy similar to what he voiced from the Prime Minister of Australia, basically afraid to say anything negative about the Islamic world. And I understand the Islamic Gulf states are more westernized, but let's be honest, where did bin Laden come from? Where did the 19 hijackers come from that killed 3,000 Americans? Where does the money come from that funds all these different groups? Where do you think Qatar, where do you think their money goes to? And where did they think the $50 million a year, is that what it is, subsidizing American Middle East departments on college campuses where we hear globalize the Intifada? Well, we saw the globalization of the Intifada. They had to cancel a Christmas celebration in Paris. Who did that? Were that the Jews that did that? Did they say, if you have Christmas and you're not Jewish, we're going to disrupt it? Just the Germans are afraid to do it. The Jews a problem there? I don't think that's true. We don't know who the brown shooter was, but there are reports that somebody yelled some type of Islamic statement. And I don't want to rush to judgment, but I don't think the shooter is going to be found to be a Jewish nationalist. So every aspect of what he said is inaccurate.
Every aspect of what Tucker said, that was his interview in Qatar, I think we played it on the program, talking about how we don't get anything from our relationship with Israel. Man, we should be really in a relationship with Qatar. And you have a voice, and people just gobble that up. People just gobble up what Tucker says. They need an astute observer like that, who's been in it for decades, to come along and say, that's just not just like a bad policy, it's wrong. It's factually incorrect. It's wrong. But no matter. I mean, Tucker's trying real hard to slice America off from Israel. Netanyahu is actually in Florida, as I said, this past week. He's trying to meet with Trump. He met with Trump. He met with him a couple of times. It all looked great, right? All looked great. He's trying to get him involved in what's happening in Iran right now, being willing to strike against Iran's growing nuclear weapons program, again, ballistic weapons program. They're building them back up. There's even reports that Iran is focusing on chemical weapons right now, trying to get support for that. He's trying to get support for, hey, Hamas isn't disarming. You said they would have disarmed as part of this deal, but they're not disarming. Can't we go in there now? And it's like 2 months, 2 months. But Netanyahu's there. He understands the value of the American relationship, particularly with Trump. Now, the rest of the cabinet don't really like Netanyahu that much. I mean, Rubio, he's probably a pro-Netanyahu realist on foreign policy. Many of the others don't really like Netanyahu. But he was there doing his best to salvage as much as possible this relationship with Trump himself. And what he does is provides him with a bit of flattery. Everyone in the cabinet and a lot of political observers know that President Trump's weakness is flattery from others. And so what does he do? He gives him the Israel Prize. This is a prize that's awarded for Israeli citizens up till now. This is a meeting that took place in Mar-a-Lago between each delegation of President Trump and Netanyahu from this week.
You're talking to President Trump. Could you tell him what I think you're going to tell him?
What?
Dear President Trump,
I can't explain.
My great and distinct honor to inform you that the Israeli Prize Committee, following Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recommendation, has reached a historic decision to award you the Israel Prize in the category Special Contribution to the Jewish People. This marks the first time since the establishment of the State of Israel that the Israel Prize is awarded to a non-Israeli citizen. This category created to recognize individuals whose actions have left an exceptional and enduring impact on the Jewish people in Israel and throughout the world. The committee noted your significant and consistent efforts on behalf of the Jewish people and the State of Israel. Among your many contributions are your commitment to fight and actions against anti-Semitism, your dedicated efforts to advance the return of Israeli hostages safely to their families, your formal recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and the relocation of the United States Embassy, your recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, and your unwavering support for Israel's right to defend itself, including during a period in which Israel confronted seven active fronts and face, together with Prime Minister Netanyahu, the critical challenge posed by Iran's nuclear deal, nuclear ambitions.
You forgot the B2s. Add it.
Well, Mr. Minister, thank you very much. It's a great honor.
Yes,
it's really amazing to be the first one outside of Israel is really something. And I look forward to meeting you. And again, thank you very much.
So that's pretty nice to get awarded the Israel Prize for President Trump. Indeed, he has done a lot for the state of Israel, particularly in his first term when, and I mean, this was really important to his election. Pro-Israel opposition has been pretty favorable to the electorate before, and it's been a winning formula to be very pro-Israel. And he filled his, he had a lot in his cabinet, evangelicals that were very supportive of the state of Israel as well in his first term. A lot's changed since then. There's still some good things he does. I think he believes, he doesn't like seeing people die. He wants to get hostages back. His methods, though, and his desires for peace sometimes go outside of what is actually good for the Jewish people or the state of Israel. But Prime Minister Netanyahu is doing all he can to get some more favors from President Trump. Now, he's got the cabinet there. There's one, if you noticed, there's one very important figure, not at that meeting, the figure that is in the center of the anti-Israel movement inside the United States that nobody really wants to talk about, Mr. J.D. Vance, the vice president of the United States. He wasn't there. Now, it's interesting. There was a tweet that was put out by Netanyahu. You could show this tweet. I think it's got it further on, but it's quite funny that it's like they knew that everyone would look at that meeting and think, oh, where's Vance? Where's Vance? Where's the vice president here? Where's Vance, who is best friends or close to Tucker Carlson, who has just come out and said that we can't on the right, we're big tent. We can't throw any ideas outside of the big tent. Everyone's welcome. Obviously, he's referring to Tucker Carlson, his anti, and what he believes is welcome inside this movement. He wasn't there. And so Netanyahu, trying to do some damage control, has to put out this tweet. The tweet says, following his successful meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, Prime Minister Netanyahu held a warm conversation last night with U.S. VP J.D. Vance, which focused on regional issues. Okay, token phone call, well done. But really, it's hiding. It's hiding the abscess inside the American administration that really is kind of on the side of, well, Israel isn't that important for our alliance. For our security. And, you know, these ideas that Tucker's bringing forth, this is a serious conversation that needs to be had within the conservative movement. And then the New York Times comes out and says, well, hang on a second. Is the Republican Party actually going to turn anti-Israel? Ted Cruz came out this month and said, within 5 years, Republicans will have a position that is anti-Israeli. Anti-Israel. Within 5 years. That's what he says. I do not think it is going to last that long. Melanie Phillips had an article. I suggest you read it. It's not behind a paywall. It's entitled American Conservatism and the Jewish Question. She takes aim at the silence and some of the statements of J.D. Vance on this. And I'm not here just saying, picking on J.D. Vance. I think it's far bigger than this, but he is definitely one within the administration that could come out and be very strong, sideline the anti-Semitic voices, but no. He's not saying that. One of those influential conservatives, Melanie Phillips writes, however, is none other than the U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance, who is another of Carlson's friends. Vance closed the conference, this is talking about, I think this is the Turning Point Conference, by decrying purity tests and said, I didn't bring a list of conservatives to denounce or deplatform. Everyone knows he's talking about Tucker. In a subsequent interview on the website Unheard, he made some even more troubling remarks. Although he said that anti-Semitism and all forms of ethnic hatred, quote, have no place in the conservative movement, end quote, he also said that the idea that Carlson's views, quote, are somehow completely anathema to conservatism, that he has no place in the conservative movement, is frankly absurd. So he's saying that his whatever Tucker says here, we need to bring it into our conservative movement. Again, this is the very end of Melanie Phillips' piece. She says, it's a bitter irony that while left-wingers regard Jews as evil, because they are viewed as the source of capitalism. Right-wingers regard Jews as evil because they are viewed as the source of communism. The Groypers and the Kiafi-clad classes are joined at the hip by their mutual hatred for Jews. The battle lines over the soul of the Republican Party and American conservatism are now clear. Remarkably, this war to define American values is being fought principally over the Jews. But abandoning Israel and turning on the Jews will be the death of the Republican Party and will also signal the death of America. I mean, if it goes in this direction, as it looks like it's going, and biblical prophecy actually says it's going to continue. Yes, the Republican Party is going to become an anti-Israel party. That's what the Bible says. America is going to become, at least its leadership and the ones making the decisions, an anti-Israel nation. This is what Zechariah chapter 11 and verse 14 says. Zechariah, it's a book written late 6th century, 520s in there. It's written far after the time period that Israel is no longer a nation, right? Israel was taken into captivity in the late 8th century BC, and Judah taken captivity into the early 6th century BC, and this is 100 years plus after that. And yet it states in this prophecy, "Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I may break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel." So when did this happen, Zechariah? Judah didn't exist. Israel didn't exist as nation states at the time. And yet you're saying that this is going to be broken apart. Well, you can read, you continue to read through Zechariah, and it's very clearly end time, latter day time prophecy. And so we know that there is going to be a break between Judah, which is the Jews, the southern kingdom of Judah, making up Levi, Benjamin, and Judah, and then Israel, which is the northern kingdom. And we know from other prophecies that the name of Israel was placed on Ephraim and Manasseh, and those tribes today make up the United States and the British Commonwealth. Again, the United States and Britain in prophecy states all this clearly for you, as does Mystery of the Ages. And so you have in there God saying that he is going to bring about this breakup. As America and its values and its morals disintegrates, and there is a noticeable break between it and the state of Israel, who is imperfect, of course, not necessarily taking the moral high ground here for the Jewish state. Nevertheless, I am bringing to you the authority of the Bible saying that there's an end time prophecy where Israel and Judah will be separated. The brotherhood will be separated. And if you want to talk about a brotherhood between nations, well, America and the Jewish state, they've been pretty close. And that's going to be broken. There's another parallel prophecy of this. This one's found in Isaiah chapter 9. It says this in Isaiah 9 and verse 21. It says, "Manasseh, Ephraim," these are these two end time tribes of Israel that make up Manasseh, the United States, Ephraim, the UK, British Commonwealth. Manasseh, Ephraim, Ephraim, Manasseh, together they shall be against Judah. Wow. I mean, this is something you wouldn't see coming 20 years ago if you didn't look at the Bible. It was there. It's been there. Isaiah's a late 8th century prophet, or 8th century prophet. 2,750 years ago is when this was given. And it says, in the end, there's going to be Ephraim and Manasseh, and they're going to be actually against Judah. Now, if you go back through the book of Isaiah, you see that Judah actually is so worried about Ephraim and Manasseh because Israel together, Ephraim and Manasseh, they actually fight against Judah. And Judah has to be like, well, what are we going to do? We've got Israel coming against us. And what do? They go to the Assyrian and they say, "Assyria, please, please come and help us. Please come and help us out of this situation." And Assyria, if you also know who that nation is, and the United States and Britain in prophecy talks about this, modern day Assyria, there's prophecies for modern day Assyria, but the Assyrian nation, no one called Assyria anywhere. Yet we know they're going to play into end time events. So where are they? Well, they are the German people. We have a reprint called The Remarkable Identity of the German People, I believe it is. The Holy Roman Empire in prophecy also talks about this, that these Assyrians that ancient Judah went to because Israel was being very violent towards Judah. Well, they're the modern day Germans. And this is just so interesting because at the precise time, this is something Mr. Stephen Flory and Sam Livingston have focused on, at the precise time that you see a breaking of America and Israel, and America, a lot of Americans loving it, well, what's Israel left to do? Well, they decide that they're going to go get the help of the Assyrians. And if you look, you just type in Germany and Israel, put it in Google search, put news, hit last month and go, you know, find me all these stories. There is a flood of stories about this, stemming from initially the setting up of the Arrow missile defensive shield inside Germany. This is the lots of countries. This is made in Israel with the help of the United States. It's to knock out ballistic missiles that are coming across mid-flight. Very hard to do. Everyone thinks the Germans want it for Russia. No, they actually want it for Iran. And that's the underlying truth of it. But Israel has it. It's the best technology out there. The Israelis have all these offers. Please sell us the Arrow 2. This is what knocked out the ballistic missiles that Iran fired. The THAAD system, the US system, isn't as effective at all compared to the Israeli system. And Israel says, we choose Germany. The Germans can have it. And so December this year, this is what is established inside Germany. The Arrow system becomes viable, active. Jewish technology is now defending Europe, particularly the German state. If you can play the clip about this, that'd be great.
We are celebrating the initial operational capability of the Arrow 3 weapon system for Germany. As the world's first operational exo-atmospheric long-range interception that the system demonstrated during the war, it provides Germany with a proven capability to defend its citizens against evolving ballistic missile threats. Arrow 3 is the result of decades of research, engineering, and innovation led by the Israeli Missile Defense Organization within the Israeli Ministry of Defense, the DDR&D, together with U.S. Missile Defense Agency. Its development reflects a long-standing national mission, designing systems whose sole purpose is to protect human life. The system credibility is rooted in extensive operational experience. This achievement is also a powerful expression of the deep friendship, trust, and shared values between Germany and Israel. Together, we are building a safer future.
Together, we're building a safer future. If students of Bible prophecy know that this future involving Germany and Israel is not going to be safe. It's not going to be safe. There's numerous prophecies that speak about this double cross that takes place when Israel invites the Germans in to be their ally. Then, as it happened in ancient Judah, as it prophesies in Hosea, as it prophesies in Isaiah as well, and even Micah, I mean, there's not a great fruits from this, but this relationship is growing really strong right now. A couple of articles I'll leave you with. This is Israel-Germany's rekindled alliance presents a strategic opportunity. This is Jerusalem Post, December 28th. In the last 2 weeks of December, the relations between Israel and Germany got a serious upgrade, talking about the Arrow 3 system. This was valued at $3.1 billion at first, and then they upgraded it, so now it's at $8 billion. This article, another quote from it, Germany has the largest and the strongest economy in Europe. It's a founding member of the EU and the most active political force on the continent. It is, since the days of its unification, the strongest European country in every aspect. In that capacity, it's very important, some may argue, it is very important, some may argue, indispensable ally of the Jewish state. Later it writes that it needs to diversify some of its military armaments, and Israel's producing a lot of them. And then it says, it goes down, the West needs a strong, assertive Germany. Israel needs a friend on the continent that is in decline and lost to dreams and misplaced expectations. And so Germany's it. Let's side with Germany. This other one, it's by just yesterday. It's in an unstable world, Israel's defense tech has become its diplomatic anchor. Meaning that, you know, Israel is just surging ahead in defense technology. The world's more dangerous. So what are they going to do? They're going to need Israel. Well, they're going to need us. They're going to need us to help them defend from all the threats. And if they need us, we'll be allies. They'll never turn against us because they need us. We're essential to their defense. No one's going to turn, you know, if this sounds to you like some historic precedent has happened with the Jewish people inside Germany that were so high up and so necessary in the German economy, that many's like, there's no way Germany's going to turn against the Jews in its own country. Why cut off your arm? Why cut off the thing that's defending or that's building up our state? It doesn't make financial sense. It doesn't make strategic sense for Europe or Germany to break off their relationship with the United States. So it's a safe bet. And that's what Judah is doing right now. That's what the nation of Israel is doing. They're deciding that it's time to reach out to their former enemy with help. Just from this article, a couple of quotes. Something unexpected is happening beneath the surface. A powerful engine of economic security and diplomatic resilience is emerging from defense technology, a sector once viewed as Israel's niche. Over the past few years, Israel's defense tech industry has evolved into a global powerhouse. In a global system driven by interests and advanced by defense capabilities are the interests and the motivates nations to remain aligned with us. These trends reflect a sobering global intuition. The world is preparing for conflict. The arms race is accelerating, and the defense sector is becoming one of the most strategically important industries on the planet. This dynamic is clearly visible in Europe's courtship of Israel's defense industry. And so it goes on to talk about how this environment is going to bring Israel in. United States might be sidelining us, but the Europeans are waiting for us. They want us. They need us, in fact. And you can see why this is such a danger for the Jewish state to then go in and believe that they have changed and that they're actually befriending the Jewish state as well. If you want to read more about the prophecy about this, you can go ahead and read Jerusalem and Prophecy or The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem. Both these books talk about the end time betrayal of Judah by the modern day Assyrians. This is all happening. God said it was going to be foretold. God foretold it thousands of years ago. And this is what we need to look at. We need to look at these prophecies in terms of God prophesying them, them coming to pass. And if they come to pass, then what's next after it as well? And there is plenty of good news there. That's it from me. If you've got feedback, send it to td@thetrumpet.com. We're going to finish Friday, as is customary, with World Watch. Thanks for being with me.
U.S. President Donald Trump launched a strike against Islamic State targets on Christmas Day in response to attacks on Nigerian Christians. In November, Trump said Christianity faces an existential threat in Nigeria and promised to defend Christians in the region. Fighters from the Islamist group Boko Haram and from an offshoot affiliated with the Islamic State called the Islamic State West Africa Province have been attacking Christian and Muslim civilians. Another group, called the Lakarawa Group, has recently become more active. Iran also has a powerful proxy in Nigeria, called the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, though it is not involved in the latest fighting. President Trump provided few details about the strike, but an unnamed Defense Department official said it had been approved by the Nigerian government. Watch for North Africa to become a new battlefront in the intensifying struggle between Christianity and Islam. Bible prophecy forecasts that it will be Europe, not the United States, that will intervene powerfully and violently take over the leading role. To learn more, read Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's article, Watch Algeria. Israel recognized Somaliland as an independent country on December 26th, becoming the first country to do so. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu invited the president of Somaliland to visit Israel and offered cooperation between the two countries. By working with this nation sitting on the Gulf of Aden across from Yemen, Israel could gain leverage to counter Iran's presence in the southern Red Sea. Yemen sits near the southern passage to the Red Sea. There, through its proxy Houthi terrorist group, Iran has been able to threaten Israel and world shipping in general. The Houthis have attacked Western cargo vessels and have even directly attacked Israel with ballistic missiles. Evidence suggests that Iran also has influence over the African nation of Eritrea, located further north on the Red Sea coast. Djibouti, located between Somaliland and Eritrea, is home to military bases from the US, China, France, Japan, Italy, and Spain, highlighting the global strategic importance of this passage. For the past several years, Iran has used its control over the Red Sea to harm Israel severely. To understand how this war will intensify, read Mr. Flory's article, "Is the Red Sea Crisis About to Fulfill Bible Prophecy?" China deployed its Navy, Coast Guard, Air Force, and Rocket Force for live-fire military drills in locations around Taiwan on December 29th, in the latest sign of the Chinese Communist Party's intensifying determination to seize the island nation. The Chinese government said the drills were designed to test sea-air coordination and precise target hunting and neutralization. The forces involved simulated a blockade of Taiwan's major ports and operations against outside powers that try to assist the nation. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that in the event of conflict with Taiwan, Russia will back China. The drills come days after the U.S. approved the largest ever arms sale to Taiwan, worth more than $11 billion. The measure seemed like a notable step for the defense of democracy, but doubts are growing about whether a war-weary United States, increasingly perceived as unreliable by its allies, will come to Taiwan's defense if China acts. To learn more, read Mr. Flory's article, "Taiwan Betrayal." To learn more about current world news and how it relates to Bible prophecy, please visit thetrumpet.com.